ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ श्रीमद्भागवतम् 5th canto, chapter 16, a description of Jambudvip, text 11 through 21. On the four sides of the great mountain known as Sumeru are four mountains: Mandara, Meru Mandara, Suparshva, and Kumuda, which are like its belts. The length and height of those mountains are calculated to be 10,000 yojanas, 80,000 miles. Standing like flagstaffs on the summits of those four mountains are a mango tree, a rose apple tree, a kadamba tree, and a banyan tree. Those trees are calculated to have a width of 100 yojanas, 800 miles, and a height of 1,100 yojanas, 8,800 miles. Their branches also spread to a radius of 1,100 yojans. O Maharaj Pritchett, best of the Bharat dynasty, between these four mountains are four huge lakes. The water of the first tastes just like milk, the water of the second like honey, and that of the third like sugarcane juice. The fourth lake is filled with pure water. The celestial beings, such as the Siddhas, Charanas, and Gandharvas, who are also known as demigods, enjoy the facilities of those four lakes. Consequently, they have the natural perfections of mystic yoga, such as the power to become smaller than the smallest or greater than the greatest. There are also four celestial gardens named Nandana, Chaitrarata, Vibhrajaksha, and Sarvatopadra. The best of the demigods, along with their wives, who are like the ornaments of heavenly beauty, meet together and enjoy within those gardens, while their glories are sung by lesser demigods known as Gandharvas. On the lower slopes of Mandara Mountain is a mango tree named Devachuta. It is 1,100 yojanas high, mangoes as big as mountain peaks, and as sweet as nectar fall from the top of this tree for the enjoyment of the denizens of heaven. Purport. In the Vayu Purana, there is also a reference to this tree by great learned sages. When all those solid fruits fall from such a height, they break, and the sweet fragrance juice within them flows out and becomes increasingly more fragrant as it mixes with other scents. That juice cascades from the mountain in waterfalls and becomes a river called Arunoda, which flows pleasantly through the eastern side of Ilavrata. The pious wives of the Yakshas act as personal maidservants to assist Bhavani, the wife of Lord Shiva. Because they drink the water of the river Arunoda, their bodies become fragrant. And as the air carries away that fragrance, it perfumes the entire atmosphere for 80 miles around. Similarly, the fruits of the jambu tree, which are full of pulp and have very, very small seeds, fall from a great height and break to pieces. Those fruits are the size of elephants, and the juice gliding from them becomes a river named Jambu Nadi. This river falls a distance of 10,000 yojans from the summit of Meru Mandara to the southern side of Ilavrata and floods the entire land of Ilavrata with juice. Purport. We can only imagine how much juice there might be in a fruit that is the size of an elephant but has a very tiny seed. Naturally, the juice from the broken jambu fruits forms waterfalls and floods the entire land of Ilavrata. That juice produces an immense quantity of gold as will be explained in the next verses. We'll stop there. Om Agnanachimananasya Agnananjana Shalakaya Chakshun. So, in this chapter, you're getting very inconceivable information, not about the spiritual world, but about the material world. In other words, there is so much just about this limited material cosmos that is beyond the range of our senses. The first step in humility is to admit that this material cosmos is inconceivable to the tiny human capacity, and what to speak of the spiritual world. There are so many beings just on this planet that if you heard about it, you would think, can that really be true? Now why, just because it is not within your experience, should you doubt that there in the material world are fruits as big as elephants with very tiny seeds, and when they fall from such huge heights and break on the ground, they create waterfalls of fruit juice. That's not within your experience. If you want some juice, if you're fortunate, you'll get fresh juice. Otherwise, you'll go to the store, get some bottled or canned juice, which is 2 years old. All the nutrition is gone. You're just drinking it because there's a mental idea in your mind. I want to drink some apple juice or some orange juice. So you go get from the store the bottled fruit juice with so many preservatives in it and artificial flavoring. And then you think, oh, now I'm becoming satisfied. Then when you hear about the inconceivable information in this chapter, you have some doubts. Mangoes as big as mountain peaks and as sweet as nectar fall from the top of this tree, which is 1,100 yojanas high. That's 8,800 miles high. So what happens when a mango as big as a mountain peak falls a distance of 8,800 miles? So you might doubt, is this just metaphorical? Is this mythological? Can this really be true? And Srila Prabhupada, knowing your mentality, puts in the purport. In the Vayu Purana, there's also a reference to this tree by great learned sages. In other words, can you compete with the great learned sages? The intelligent devotee accepts that there's so much going on beyond the range of my senses. People can't even understand how their own governments are operating, how their own economy is operating. So many things happen in governmental affairs, politics, finance. You don't know. You can only accept what you read in the newspaper. Now, what about the enjoyment of the demigods? In their various gardens with their wives, they're enjoying the fragrant atmosphere, the waterfalls and lakes of sugarcane juice. Yes, this sounds like the life. That probably we could more readily believe. Yes. Good sense gratification. That makes sense. Mountains that are 8,800 miles high, I don't know about that. But sense gratification with beautiful women in pleasant gardens, yes, yes. Now the Bhagavatam is becoming more real. Bodies becoming so fragrant by drinking the water of a particular river that the bodies spread their fragrance 80 miles around. These kind of things tiliate our senses. And it is a fact that on the heavenly planets, the enjoyment is far superior than the tiny sense gratification available on Earth. So we are attracted to hearing reports of enjoyment in far-off places. Of course, a devotee has to be careful. We don't want to be swayed by the enjoying attitude of the demigods. The demigods, the devas, are bhaktas. They're devotees, but they have a controlling and enjoying propensity mixed in with their devotion. We don't want that. We want to develop shuddha bhakti, pure devotion. And we're willing to recognize that as our career aspiration. We're willing to go through training, purification, refinement, so that gradually more and more our selfless love for Krishna reveals itself. We're willing to work on our service relationship with the Supreme Lord. This is what characterizes the life of a devotee. The opulences that are available to a devotee are far superior than what the demigods can experience. If you just consider Chaitanya Leela, the loving exchanges between Lord Chaitanya and his devotees, nothing the demigods taste can compare to that. No heavenly planet's garden can compare to the garden of love that Lord Chaitanya and his associates participate in. You don't read about the demigods in their various gardens falling on the ground in ecstasy, tears pouring from their eyes. You don't read about that. Such symptoms of ecstasy are the characteristic of Lord Chaitanya and his dealings with his devotees. In the movement of Prem Sankirtan. As pleasurable as the demigod's world appears, it does not satisfy the soul. It stimulates the mind, stimulates the body, but the soul is not touched. Therefore, a devotee rejects such so-called pleasures, knowing they will not solve your problem. And sooner or later, you have to give those pleasures up in the heavenly planets. Now, when we look at Lord Chaitanya's Leela, we see that even though Lord Chaitanya's pastimes happened during a time, a material time in India, when the Mohammedans were ruling, and there was even danger from the Mohammedans, still, Lord Chaitanya's movement went on in terms of his loving exchanges with his devotees. There were no facilities like the heavenly planets. Yet, there was something far superior. That was chanting and dancing and devotee reciprocation. Ecstasies so intense that often Kaviraj Goswami says, I cannot put into words what these devotees were feeling. I cannot describe their ecstasies. Now, if Kaviraj Goswami says that, then what can you say? He's the superlative author of the superlative scripture, Chaitanya Charitamrita. For example, Lord Chaitanya wanted to go to Vrindavan. Now, what is wrong with the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the best devotee wanting to visit Vrindavan? Pratapurutra Maharaj heard about that, and he became very morose. Oh, I've attained the greatest fortune that Lord Chaitanya is in my kingdom. Now he wants to go. Because he's a Kshatriya, as well as a great devotee, he doesn't just lament. He's proactive. What does he do? He summons Ramananda Roy, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. and he tells him submissively. I've heard Lord Chaitanya wants to leave and go to Vrindavan. Please do something. Put impediments in his path. Come up with some schemes. Keep him here in Jagannath Puri. Because without his presence in Jagannath Puri, my kingdom is useless for me. Remember previously, in order to get Lord Chaitanya's darshan, the king had said, he had threatened, if I don't get the darshan of Lord Chaitanya, I'm going to give up my position and become a beggar, house to house. Mm-hmm. Now, once again, he's showing his attachment for the Lord. My kingdom means nothing if he leaves. What was Pratyapuja Maharaj afraid of? He's a powerful warrior administrator. What was his fear in Lord Chaitanya's leaving Jagannath Puri? He feared the fire of separation. This is part of pure love of Krishna. He feared the impending separation. We'll just burn up in that fire like pieces of dry grass. That feeling is real. It's not that he is being without faith in the Lord, without confidence in bhakti, but the intense pleasure of serving Lord Chaitanya when he's in Jagannath Puri so predominated the king's mind, he couldn't imagine life without it. But whether Lord Chaitanya is coming or going, devotees are always nourished. Lord Chaitanya is known as Gauramegha. He's the cloud, Gaur, who by his glance pours nectar upon the devotees. And in this way, the devotees become nourished just by the glance of Lord Chaitanya. This is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Maybe some of you have experienced how you were very fatigued in your service. Some service was taking everything from you, you thought. You're giving everything. And then just one glance from the deities, one glance from your spiritual master, and you're totally enlivened. These are the glories of bhakti, these reciprocal exchanges. So, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and Ramananda Roy began to present impediments to Lord Chaitanya. Vaishnav impediments. Lord Chaitanya said, I would like to go to Vrindavan. So, Ramananda Roy and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya told him, oh, very good, very good. Just wait until Rath Yatra. Then you may go. Then Rath Yatra came and went. And so the two again told Lord Chaitanya, wait, wait, just wait till Kartik. Then you can go. Kartik came and went. And Ramananda Roy and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya told Lord Chaitanya, well, now it's very cold. It's after Kartik, it's so cold. Wait till Dol Yatra. Then you can go. So in this way, they delayed and delayed and delayed Lord Chaitanya. Now, is this some kind of great offense? No. These are the dealings of a love that Kaviraj Goswami says is so intense it's difficult to put into words. It's a love that can only be fully understood by the confidential associates of Lord Chaitanya. How dare Ramananda Roy and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya stop Lord Chaitanya from going to Vrindavan? Meanwhile, for the Rath Yatra, the residents of Navadvip, Shantipur, they're making their annual trip to Jagannath Puri. Nityananda was not supposed to come. He was supposed to have stayed in Bengal to preach. But he came anyway, pushed by ecstatic love. This is the point. There's something going on that is inconceivably more superior than what the demigods are tasting on the heavenly planets. There's something going on that even the greatest Vaishnav author can't put into words. So Nityananda came anyway. Now, after some time, Lord Chaitanya, actually 2 years of this past, can you just think you want to go to Vrindavan and for 2 years someone schemes to keep you from not, prevent you from going? 2 years went by like this. Finally, Lord Chaitanya approached Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya Ramananda Roy, and he said, look, for so long now you have schemed, you have kept me here. Please, I'm asking your permission. Please allow me to go to Vrindavan. Just see, Lord Chaitanya is teaching that a devotee always seeks the blessings of other devotees. This is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As a devotee, demonstrating, please give me your blessings to go to Vrindavan. Just like I was, before class, I was speaking with Yadubar Prabhu, and he was telling me about some possibility of making animated Krishna Leela. But there could be some technical point that 35 years ago, when someone showed Srila Prabhupada a very not so well done animated film, he didn't have a supportive reaction. So at that point, 35 years ago, it was deduced that Prabhupada wasn't into animation. Of course, since then, since 35 years ago, the technology has improved so much, the devotee's maturity has improved so much. So Yadubar Prabhu, he was looking for blessings or acknowledgement from someone he mistakenly thought to be a Vaishnava. But in any case, this is the way that devotees behave, real devotees. Even Lord Chaitanya does that. Please give me your blessings to go to Vrindavan. I know all about your schemes. So Ramananda Roy and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya felt very bad. But try to understand, their motives were pure. They were not acting out of sense gratification. This is just part of pure loving dealings. They sincerely, purely feared the flames of separation. It's not that they wanted to keep Lord Chaitanya there for their own sense gratification. No, their motivation is beyond that. They're feeling the pressure of pure love, so they can't be blamed. So then, Lord Chaitanya made preparations for his departure. He was going to go to Vrindavan through Bengal, because he said, I have two shelters in Bengal, Gangamayi and my mother. I'll take shelter of both of them when I leave Jagannath Puri, and then I'll proceed to Vrindavan. So the Lord left. Before getting on his way, he took permission from Lord Jagannath. See, this is bhakti. First the Vaishnavs, then the Supreme Personality Godhead. And Lord Chaitanya left. And all the devotees in Orissa wanted to follow him. The Lord Chaitanya had to forbid them. No, 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 please don't come with me. Some of his personal associates remained with him for some distance. One of them shouldn't have been there at all, leaving Jagannath Puri. Who was that? Gadadhar. Gadadhar Pandit should not have left Jagannath Puri. He had taken a vow of Chaitra Sannyas, the superior form of Vanaprastha, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in the age of Kali. He had taken a vow, I will not go outside the holy dham of Jagannath Puri. Yet, he was walking with Lord Chaitanya. Furthermore, Gadadhar had taken a vow of lifelong service to the Gopinath deity. How could he abandon both Jagannath Puri and the seva to Gopinath? So Lord Chaitanya reminded him, number one, you have the Chaitra Sannyas vow not to leave Jagannath Puri. What was Gadadhar Pandit's response? Let my Chaitra Sannyas vow go to hell. Wherever you are, that is Jagannath Puri. This is not just some neophytist statement. This is the pushings of pure love. Can't be imitated. Then, Lord Chaitanya said, what about your vow of lifelong service to Gopina? Gadadhara Pandit said, just by seeing your lotus feet, I'm serving Gopinath a million times over. He had an answer for everything. And Lord Chaitanya said, if you come with me, the blame will be on me for your breaking Dharma, breaking your vows. I'll get the blame. Gadadhar had an answer for that too. He said, oh, I won't exactly come with you. I'll walk alone, even though we're going to the same place, you see? And in this way, it cannot be said that it's your fault, because I'm just walking aloof alone. I'm just doing my own thing, and we just happen to all be winding up at Satchimata's house, you see? So Lord Chaitanya relented, and after some time, though, Lord Chaitanya called Gadadhar to his party. In other words, we might as well walk together. What's the use of this ruse? So, they walked further and further, and finally, Lord Chaitanya turned to Gadadhar, grabbed his hand, and spoke with apparent anger. Actually, in his heart, Lord Chaitanya was pleased. This is how much Gadadhar, this is how intense his love is. But externally, he feigned anger, because simultaneously, while acknowledging his confidential devotee's pure love, he also had to uphold Dharma. So though he was pleased in his heart, externally, he was angry as he caught Gadadhar's hand and said, look, you've done enough already. You've come so far, you've broken your vows. This desire to be with me is just sense gratification. Better you go back to Jagannath Puri. I don't want to speak any more about this. So there's nothing more to be said at that point in this relationship of the highest love. So Lord Chaitanya at that point got into a boat to go down a river. And then Lord Chaitanya told Gadadhar Pandit, that's it. He left. Gadadhar Pandit collapsed to the ground, unconscious. Lord Chaitanya kept going and told Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, you take care of him. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya roused Gadadhar, told him, this is the way the Leela is. These are the dealings of Lord Chaitanya. So I often like to say, how can you object when Vaishnava preachers say there's practically no love in the material world? How many of you, when your beloved consort or child or mother or father leaves to go for a journey and you collapse on the floor unconscious? Has anyone done that here? Not going away completely, but just on a journey and coming back later. But you feel the flames of separation so much that as they walk out the door, you collapse on the ground unconscious. Anyone? No. Therefore, we say, we don't know what real love is in the material world. But often, people become upset by that. When I speak about these things in Ukraine and Russia, I have to work on the devotees to come out with their doubts, because it's a big thing for them to admit that there's practically no love in the material world. There's just a perverted reflection, because these countries are so difficult to live in that these sentiments of relationships are the only thing people really have to cling to. So it's difficult to hear that actually in this material world there is no real love. But when we hear Chaitanya Leela, the loving exchanges between Lord Chaitanya and his devotees, then we start to understand. Since when have I displayed such ecstatic symptoms in a personal relationship? Since when have I collapsed on the ground unconscious when the beloved departed? So, think about Lord Chaitanya, however. I think that's a side that you often don't think about when you hear this Leela. You're thinking about Gadadhar Pandit. But Lord Chaitanya was also feeling the pain of separation from Gadadhar. But he tolerated that separation feeling just to keep the vows of Gadadhar, of Chaitra Sannyas and Gopinath Seva. Think about things from Lord Chaitanya's side. The pain of separation was difficult for him, but he overlooked that to maintain Gadadhar's vows. The example Kaviraj Goswami gives is the Lord's maintaining Bhishma Dev's promise in the battle of Kurukshetra. This is the exquisiteness of Chaitanya Charitamrita. There's examples coming from all different shastras, the best legal evidence Kaviraj Goswami calls upon. What happened? You know that Kurukshetra history where Bhishma had made the promise, I will fight so vigorously that unless Krishna breaks his promise not to fight and acts to save Arjuna, Arjuna is finished. Bhishma made that vow. And indeed, he was fighting in such a way that his vow looked like it was definitely going to be fulfilled, that he would kill Arjuna unless Krishna did something, unless Krishna broke his promise. Meanwhile, what was Arjuna doing? He was fighting half-heartedly out of respect for Bhishma. He was not giving his all-in-all in the battle, even though Bhishma was mounting such a ferocious attack. And Krishna, his charity, is noticing, what's happening to Arjuna? Where is his fighting ability? If things go on like this, all of the Pandava side is going to be annihilated. Bhishma is so intent on destroying everything. So finally, Krishna had to act. Arjuna was half-heartedly fighting. Bhishma was about to, was fighting like the cosmic annihilation. Krishna had to break his promise. He jumped off the chariot, found a chariot wheel on the ground, picked it up, and ran towards Bhishma, yelling, I'm going to get you. You stood up for Adharma. You fought on the wrong side just because you're supported by those Kauravas. I'm going to get you. And what did Bhishma do? Ecstasy, come on, kill me. Oh, nothing can be better than this. And Krishna's running towards him. Meanwhile, Arjuna realizes what's happening. Oh, no. Because I was fighting so half-heartedly out of respect for Bhishma. Now Krishna has to break his promise just to protect me. So Arjuna is running after Krishna. And Krishna's running after Bhishma. This whole scene is going on. And Bhishma's there. Come on, kill me, come on. Nothing can be better than this. And Krishna's yelling at Bhishma, you fought on the wrong side. You're trying to kill my devotee. I'm going to get you. Finally, Arjuna catches Krishna and tackles him practically. You know, grabs him around the legs with both of his arms. But Krishna is so determined, he keeps on going, dragging Arjuna, who's holding on to his legs. And Bhishma is just waiting. Kill me, yes, kill me. You're breaking your promise just to protect your devotee, and you're maintaining my promise. Finally, Arjuna digs in his heels and is able to bring Krishna to a halt. And then Arjuna promises, I will fight so vigorously. I will give up my half-hearted fighting. Please, you don't break your promise any further. And at that moment, the conch sounded, and the day of fighting was over. technically, Krishna didn't break his promise. He picked up a chariot wheel, which is not a weapon. But that's a fine point. Actually, he did break his promise. From the platform of love, when looked at in that way, he broke his promise to maintain the promise of Bhishma. In other words, the Lord inconvenienced himself for the sake of Bhishma's promise. Similarly, Kaviraj Goswami says, Lord Chaitanya inconvenienced himself. He tolerated the feelings of separation from Gadadhar just to maintain Gadadhar's promises. So what is the conclusion? Kaviraj Goswami says, these are confidential dealings. They cannot be understood except by the most exalted devotees. So these kind of love intensities are not known in the heavenly planets, where there is just intense physical and mental sense gratification. The intense love exchanged by Lord Chaitanya and his devotees has nothing to do with any material experience, whether on the lower, middle, or upper planetary systems. How is it Gadadhar collapses on the ground, unconscious? Rupa Goswami also did the same thing. Lord Chaitanya instructed him, and then Lord Chaitanya left. And Rupa Goswami wanted to accompany him, and Lord Chaitanya told him, I have ordered you to go to Vrindavan. I've given you so many instructions, you can't go with me. You just do your service. And Lord Chaitanya left, and Rupa Goswami collapsed on the ground unconscious. Ramananda Roy also the same thing. He was one of the last residents of Jagannath Puri to accompany Lord Chaitanya on his way to Bengal. And finally, Lord Chaitanya sent him back. And he also collapsed. He could not bear the impending separation. So again and again, Kaviraj Goswami says, this kind of love can't be put into words. Sometimes, poets in the material world, they say, oh, the love I feel for this person, it cannot be described. But they're just talking about mental and physical. They're just talking about the arrangements of the material energy. Here we are dealing with the most intense love of the highest spiritual platform. And just by hearing about it, we lose our inclinations for heavenly planet sense gratification. We aspire, just let me become an associate of Lord Chaitanya, a servant of his associates. That's all I want. I don't want the fragrant breezes in the gardens of the heavenly planets. I don't want to smell the fragrance of the bodies that can perfume the atmosphere for 80 miles around. I don't want to taste the nectar from mangoes the size of mountain peaks. Just let me chant and dance with the servants of Lord Chaitanya. See, in this way, your whole concept of pleasure changes. That means purification. When your conception of what is pleasure changes, you should know that your heart is becoming cleansed. What is troubling us are the dirty things in the heart. The dirty things in the heart, first of all, mean I am this body, and secondly, I am the enjoyer. By hearing Lord Chaitanya's activities with his associates, you start to understand that the realm of selfless devotion has a taste so exquisite that nothing in the heavenly planets compares to that. And if nothing in the heavenly planets compares to that, how can anything on the earth planet compare to that? Nothing in Vaikuntha compares to this intense love exchange between Lord Chaitanya and his devotees. And it's without any selfish desire. When Rupa Goswami collapses to the ground, when Ramananda Roy collapses to the ground, when Gadadhar Pandit faints on the ground, it's not because, oh, we're losing our sense gratification. No, it's just that the separation feelings from the Lord are intolerable. They have no choice. And Lord Chaitanya is also feeling separation. So these are the exquisite bhavas that we want to become familiar with. First by hearing, and then there's purification, and then we can aspire. One day, will just a drop of that ocean of love of God, as felt by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's associates, just let a drop be mine. By hearing, the aspiration awakens in your heart, and Krishna in the heart notices, oh, you don't want the heavenly planet gardens anymore. You want to chant and dance in Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement. So in this way, just by hearing, our conceptions become reversed. Instead of being Krishna's competitor, we become Krishna's servant. All right. Any questions? Yes?
Hare Krishna. Maharaj, sorry to speak something on a completely on a lower platform than what you have spoken right now. Talking about yesterday's class and today's class, Maharaj, we have come into Krishna consciousness, we have accepted Krishna consciousness vows, and we wanted to surrender for the whole lifetime to remain in Krishna consciousness and to have that highest achievement of love of God, love of Krishna. But talking about in India, from about 10 years or so, that the economical situation has become so rampantly changed. And due to that reason, that what the problem we are facing right now in India is, talking about specifically all our anarthas, like for example our lust. As such, we have come in a conditional stage in Krishna consciousness. We were not a pure devotee. Or now we had a culture of a pure devotion. And on one side, our anarthas have not yet gone. And we see the outside world by these economical changes and Western style of, so to say, complete implementation. All half of dresses worn by the matajis and the girls. Half dresses by jeans and everything. It really contaminates our consciousness. It finds it very difficult to come a mental equilibrium point. At the same time, on one side, the lust attack is very strong. The greed, people are working like a donkey, as you were saying yesterday itself. We keep a mental equilibrium is so difficult to keep that mental equilibrium of understanding that this will be enough for us to maintain our spiritual life, not to earn more, and maintain a very smooth Krishna consciousness as a priority. In addition to that, lust and greed, always the envy is always there, pride is always there. So sometimes a situation comes that the force of this Kali Yuga or a force of this Maya has been so strong, specifically in India, from last about 8-10 years, that we get shaken up. We feel it that whether we will be able to maintain Krishna consciousness or not till the last breath of our life. I understand that you were saying yesterday that we could have a guidance and keep a very good association. But sometimes even guidance and association is also sometimes try to overcome us. And we feel that is more important rather than this. And sometimes we get shaken up. In that situation, we have a fear that whether we will be able to maintain our Krishna consciousness till the last breath of our life or not. When this type of an attack of Maya comes in our life, in the form of a lust, in the form of greed, or in form of all other anarthas, how to see to it that we don't try to get carried away and keep a very strong, committed Krishna consciousness for a whole lifetime?
There are two things going on. The degradation around you is becoming more intense, and the Krishna consciousness is becoming more intense. Lord Chaitanya has not abandoned you to the increasing degradation. He's supplying increasing more facility to be Krishna conscious. So it's just like during the rainy season, so much rain is coming down, but if you are properly protecting yourself from the rain, you will not get drenched. So we're getting more and more facility for protection, while at the same time, all around the degradation is increasing. My hunch is that what's happening now is that no longer will those in India who are, say, under the age of 30, no longer will you be able just to coast on your piety, your sentiment, you know, given by parents, grandparents. No, now you have to start using your intelligence to understand the pitfalls of Maya. It's getting too intense out there. You just can't rely on your nice manners and your cultured ways. The Maya is just the Western Maya is too powerful for that. It runs over any cultural training, any nice piety that someone may have. Those things are a good barrier for a while, but eventually they give way, as you point out. As nice as your parental upbringing has been, what happens when you turn on the TV now? What do you see? It's more powerful than nice cultural upbringing. So, my hunch is that you have to augment that nice cultural upbringing, of course, which is very valuable and is a good fortune, with the intelligence to understand the cheating ways of the illusory energy. I was talking with one devotee who's lived in India for 17 years, Brajbihari Prabhu, and he was telling me, in his vision, what's happening now in India is like what happened in the USA in the 60s when Prabhupada came. There was a huge difference between the world of the parents and the world of their children. The parents were traditional still at that point in terms of, you know, Christian work ethic, religion like that. But their children were off taking LSD, becoming hippies. The parents couldn't understand what was happening. There was a huge gulf. Therefore, the young people invented that statement, don't trust anyone over 30. Forgetting that one day they would be over 30. But that was the mood. And the parents, they were just totally bewildered. What's happening? What are they doing? They're wearing these strange clothes. They have the long hair. They're taking these drugs. They're not getting married anymore. They're not working anymore. Parents actually couldn't understand it. It was a different universe. So anyway, Brajbihari Prabhu was saying that it's like that in his vision. It's like that now in India, that the younger generation is just having a completely different mentality than what many of their parents and certainly their grandparents can understand due to the effect of the television, the movies, the music. So, no longer are we going to be able to rely so much on the piety. We're going to have to start teaching how to analyze the material energy through the Bhagavatam to protect yourself. We have to expose the cheating methods of the illusory energy, how it works on your mind. Bhagavatam does this. Srila Prabhupada said there are two types of kirtan, chanting Hare Krishna and also having talks about the duplicity, the cheating of the illusory energy and how it presents false propositions to your mind. He said that's also kirtan. And he said unless our devotees have both types of kirtan, they'll become weak and go away. So now you're feeling the onslaught right now. And no longer can you protect yourself by saying, oh, my grandmother raised me so nicely. No longer can you protect yourself just because of your past piety and good fortune. No. The movies and the television will just knock that down. So what did your mother raise you so nicely? Take a look at this. And your brains just burn. Your parents may have raised you so carefully to your good fortune, but then you go on your computer and your consciousness becomes totally possessed by these horrible, degraded things that are easily available on the internet. And everything seems to be all so conducive. You can just degrade your mind in private, while externally continuing to be very pious. So, my hunch is that the intelligence has to be strengthened. And Bhagavatam does that. It's not enough just to be nice. Now you have to be perceptive, analytical, and knowledgeable to understand what's going on out there and how it pollutes. What are the pitfalls? You actually have to deprogram yourself in terms of the propensity for material enjoyment. It takes work. I think that maybe is what you're starting to see. You could take it for granted before. Oh, we don't do these things. It's not like that anymore. Now you actually have to do some work to fortify yourself. Understand those Bhaktivedanta purports about the material illusion. Think through them and protect yourself. That's good. You have to exert yourself more to be Krishna conscious. And Lord Chaitanya is giving more. So it's a great deal, actually. You have to work harder, and Lord Chaitanya is going to give you more. It's not that Krishna is just going to abandon you. Just see. Bard Varsh is becoming inundated by all the degradation. These devotees, they have no hope. No, Krishna is giving more. But you have to be positioned to get the more. So probably what's happening is an intense polarization that in India some people are becoming more degraded and some people are going more to Krishna consciousness. But because the atmosphere is so becoming hellish, therefore the devotees are feeling beleaguered, they're feeling attacked, they're feeling drained. You have to fight back with your intelligence. The intelligence is still there due to the good upbringing, due to the good culture in the background, taking shelter of bhakti yoga. So now you have to take that good intelligence and do more than just understand IT. Now you have to understand Maya. Piety is not enough anymore to save you. Things are too degraded now. You actually have to immerse your intelligence in Bhagavad Dharma and understand how the illusory energy cheats, how it promises you everything and just gives you suffering. This is the best kind of engineering. This is the best kind of science to understand. Then you become expert in Krishna Leela. You become expert in Maya's dealings, and you got the complete package. Otherwise, I agree with you. It's very intimidating. It's very overpowering. It's like someone just takes a bucket of garbage and just pours it over your head. You just walk on the street, you see so many things. But if you know how to strengthen your intelligence through the Bhagavatam, you'll be protected.
Sorry, but my problem is this way, that to get that conviction of Bhagavatam, that Bhagavatam is everything, and if I take a complete shelter of Bhagavatam, taking complete shelter of the association of devotees, and complete shelter of the holy name, then I'll be protected. But it takes little bit time to get that conviction. But the flood of Maya, the flood of Kali Yuga has been so strong, that till the time I get that conviction, before that I'm already drowned in sense gratification. So how to see at this juncture, before I got that conviction of Bhagavatam, I'm completely safe till that time. What should I do at this moment?
At the moment of... At what moment?
At this moment, till the time I have not yet got the conviction of Bhagavatam is everything.
You must get that conviction. Just like in the job market, you must compete. You must upgrade your skills to maintain your place in the race. You must. Now you must upgrade your skills to be more Krishna conscious. You must. You got to feel that urgency. This urgency you feel is more than just piety. You've got to feel that, like a drowning man gasping for air, I've got to educate myself. I've got to purify myself. And that feeling of urgency is mercy. Lord Chaitanya likes it when you feel that way. Because it is the truth. Unless you become more Krishna conscious, there's no hope. You can't withstand all that pressure.
Maharaj, what should we do in between of our lifestyle in Krishna consciousness for the years we have to go on? If in between, because of our conditioning, we are weak, it might be so happening that that urgency level, that urgency of Krishna consciousness might become loose to our conditioning. So in that circumstances, you become little bit loose and Maya tries to overcome you.
Yes.
So at that juncture, what should we do? Because our conditioning is to become loose.
You must know how to take shelter of the association of devotees. There's no other way. You have to know how to ask for help. Now you tell me, is that in the cultural context here, is that difficult to call out like, I was looking at so many wrong things on the computer, I was starting to watch movies late at night, and now my brains are just fried. Is it normally no one would say like that? Huh? What do you say? Normally?
Normally we do it, but we don't speak because of hypocrisy.
Mm. So when someone is burning in those kind of fires, they don't just call up their counselor, call up the, I did this, I did that, and now I'm just, I'm falling, please help. Does that happen, or? Rarely? In your estimation? So? As the flames of Kali Yuga increase their intensity, those, you'll see that devotees will have to start calling out more and honestly presenting their situation and begging for help. Better that than falling down. So things are changing. What you're pointing out is that the dynamics of the situation are changing. Things are becoming more desperate. You can't be cool anymore in a pious way. Yet my family was very nice, good upbringing. I'm very pious. That is enough. The external energy is pushing so much. It's making you either cry out desperately to Lord Chaitanya or else you're carried away. But by crying out desperately to Lord Chaitanya, you make spiritual advancement. So this is what's happening. And those who increase their taking shelter at Lord Chaitanya's lotus feet, they'll become stronger and stronger. And then they'll be able to help even more persons. It's not just the Maya that's increasing. Krishna, the flood of love of God is also increasing. So don't forget that. You just have to be able to see it. So it's good that you cannot be so casual anymore. Now things are becoming intense, and so the devotees will become more intense in their Krishna consciousness. And they'll be able to accomplish wonders. Okay? Haribo? I can't see, so far I can just see a hand raised. Oh.
Maharaj, you talked about putting in more work in the context of question just now asked.
Mm-hmm.
So this putting in more work, does it just mean whatever we are doing, but doing it more intensely, or having some more inputs, like we are doing association, trying to hear Bhagavatam, mm-hmm. trying to follow the regulative principles. But when you say put in more work, exert more, What exactly is the perspective on this?
Okay, let me give an example. It's a fight. So in a fight, if someone smashes you in the cheek, you have to fight back. So you have to have that policy with Maya. You hit me, I'm hitting back. Okay, you hit me with something on the TV. I was just trying to watch the news, and then there was something else, and my brains became fried. Okay, I'm going to fight back. Where's the Bhagavatam? I'm going to the temple right now. I don't care. It takes me 2 hours to get through traffic. I'm going to save my consciousness. I'm fighting back. You have to have that kind of spirit. Because Maya will slug you. Take that. So much for your good upbringing. One lusty scene on the TV and it's all finished. So you have to know how to fight back. All right, you do that to me, I'll do this to you. I'm chanting some extra rounds. What do you say about that? I'm calling my counselor right now. What are you going to do about that? I'm going to increase my service, even 5 minutes more devotional service. What are you going to do about that? That way it actually becomes a bit like a sport, you know? You hit me, I'm hitting back. And then you start to feel how Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda are there helping you. That's the only way to fight back. You can't be passive. Oh, but I'm nice. And my parents have raised me so nicely. I was always hearing Ram Lila even when I was a little boy. Now what is all this? No, Maya doesn't respect that. Of course, it has extraordinary value, no doubt. But as you can see, what's happening now is Maya is not even respecting that. Forget your background, your upbringing. I don't care. Look at this movie. You can just get a DVD and watch it in your home, and no one will ever know. You don't even have to go to the cinema anymore. It'll all be private. And you've got your computer. So many things are available. It's not your fault that these things came to you. You just wanted to look at it for a short time only. So, you have to have this transcendental sporting attitude. Maya hits me, I hit back with an increase in Krishna consciousness. I'll chant a few extra rounds. I'll read something. Whatever. Don't stand still. Do something. Fight back. And this way you start to see it is possible to win. By Krishna's grace, Lord Chaitanya has given us the facility to win. But if you just are passive, don't communicate to other devotees, you'll be swept off your feet. That's what's happening now. You've got to do something. Take the initiative. You hit me, I'm hitting back. I'm going to chant. Who says you can't chant more? Even a couple of extra rounds, that's hitting back. Who says I can't just read 15 minutes in the Bhagavatam? Just do something to save yourself. And you'll see the difference. It starts to become ecstatic after a while. And then you can teach it to others how to fight back. All right, one last question. Here, right here. Oh, someone else.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Anyway.
We are all asking questions, and we are almost practically, the question came from devotees who are practicing Krishna consciousness for quite a number of years. And at this situation, and we are feeling that the impact of Kali Yuga is so strong that we ourselves, right, our foundation is being so shaky. Now, I'm thinking of the children we have, and these children, they are growing up, and we don't have a huge population that we can see devotees everywhere, wherever we live. And they look at us like, you know, getting affected by the Kali Yuga. They look at us, the parents, like freaks. Everybody else is different, and we are different. and everybody's house has TV, and we don't get one TV for them, they wind up going to see in their friend's house, and we have no control of what they're going to do over there. So, put in such a situation, we have to get a TV for them, and then we have to watch over it. But most of their life, they are in contact with outside world, rather than in the house, going to school so many hours, playing out so many hours. Nowadays, everybody sends their children for tuition for so many hours. Hardly they spend a few hours with the parents in the house. And they are seeing totally the opposite of what we are practicing. So, in a situation like this, we are already having so much of tough time trying to fight over with controlling our senses not to fall into the trap of Maya. But then, it looks like a bigger challenge to look into, you know, how we can protect our children from, you know, getting astray into this, I don't know how to explain, looking at the situation today. So what would you like to...
Well, you have two choices. You can adopt the path of liberal parenthood. Oh, well, they're going to do these things anyway. Better to let them do these things and learn in their own way, and that way they'll still like us and appreciate us. Or you can draw the line and say, in our home, there are certain rules. We cannot say what goes on in the outside world, but in our home, there are certain rules which we will abide by. Do you understand? Now, initially, the children may resent that, but later they'll appreciate it. So basically, you're a lot of, and I'm telling you from my own experience, I had a very strict mother from a Western standard point of view, and she would just lay down the law like that. I don't care what the neighbors are doing. I don't care what everyone else says. In this house, we will follow certain rules. That's the way it's going to be. And she said, even I know that you're going to rebel and you're going to do a little bit of these things. That's okay. It's not going to happen at home. And later you will appreciate. Because later you'll have your own families, have to raise your own children, and you'll see that mother was right. And it exactly happened like that. Now she's gloating victory. Just see. They all went back to living a proper lifestyle. And they all feel indebted toward her. Now, I know cases of parents who were very liberal, thinking their children would love them in that way, and later the children were very angry. Why did you let me do these things? Now I'm 25, 30, I realize that I was foolish, and you let me be foolish. It's like... I have one disciple, I won't tell you where, and his parents are wealthy, affluent, respectable, and they decided the best thing for raising him was to, whenever he wanted to smoke marijuana at home, let him do it at home. Why did he have to go outside and hide? Just let him sit on the living room couch and, you know, it's in that way it's all in a loving atmosphere. And then, his mother, a business lady, she got a job managing a chain of bookshops and was selling all kinds of literature. One day she just came home and casually said to him, he was 19 then, I brought some porno home from the shop. Would you like to see it? Just thinking, you know, just, I know this is, you're shocked, but, you know, just nonchalantly. Hi, dear. I brought some porno home from the shop. In other words, whatever, you know, makes you happy. We're your parents. We're going to help in that. We'll be liberal. We'll be, you know, we'll be completely permissive. And you're going to appreciate us. You're going to like us. But now, of course, their son realizes this is violence. And that is actually resented. I've seen this again and again. When the fortunate children grow up and realize that was hell you allowed happening to me, they become very resentful. But if the parents are strict, although it's a little tough during the teenage years, later the children respect that. Thank you for doing like that. So you've just got to tolerate. A lot of being a parent is toleration. When the kids are little, they're, you know, mata pita, it's all so sweet. But then you've got to tolerate the next phase in which they think you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what real pleasure is. You've got to tolerate it. That's the burden of parenthood. So, I would say, based on my own personal experience, if you as parents just lay down the law in your home, you can't be responsible for what goes on in the world. But if you lay down the law in your house and you preach very extensively, later the children will appreciate, without a doubt. But just be prepared to tolerate a little abuse and subtle abuse and lack of respect. Yeah, that's all part of parenting. Go at it for the long run. And you'll see, they'll appreciate. It's amazing how these things are becoming such intense issues here now in India. It's good to face these realities. But don't lose hope. Don't become depressed. Lord Chaitanya's mercy is even more available now than ever before. So don't think, oh, it's hopeless. I thought my boy was immediately going to be Prahlad Maharaj. Now he wants to watch television. What to do? You just lay down the law in your home. Like my mother, we had a television. I mean, living in the West, you know, if you're not a devotee, it's impossible to conceive of not having a television. But she monitored every show we watched. And everyone in the neighborhood knew it and made fun of us. Your mother doesn't let you watch everything on television. Your mother doesn't let you go to parties. I think I've told you one story, yes? I told you one story about... I won't tell you about myself. I'll tell you about my brothers. Yeah, I told you, yes? Everyone knows. I won't repeat it. Huh? I was 13 and my brother was 11 and a half. And we were talking with the neighborhood boys. And amongst the neighborhood boys, there was especially one cool guy who was about 14. And he would always brag about how he was tasting all the Kali Yuga abominable experiences and relishing so much. Actually, it was all mostly talk, but, you know, just hot air boasting. Oh, I was with so many girls, and last weekend we did this, we did that, and just boasting of that. It's actually... lies, but you know, we didn't know that. He was just a cool guy. So then we were listening, and my brother starts getting affected. My brother says, oh, yes, I do the same thing. I have so many girlfriends. I was doing this last week and that. And I'm watching. Because I know he's lying, but he's just getting affected, you know? So I immediately knew what to do. Tell mother. So I went back to the house. I told mother, do you know what he's out there doing? He's out there telling the neighborhood boys that he has illicit sex. Oh, my mother's eyes became fiery like coals. Bring him here immediately. So I went, and my brother is still talking with the boys. Yeah, yeah, I party, I drink, I do this. So right while he's in the midst of that, I say, mother wants to see you. And all the guys are, aha, we see you're just a mama's boy, all that big talk, now we see where you're really at. So I brought him to my mother, and she just tore into him. How dare you embarrass this family? How dare you condemn this family by talking like that? I never raised you in this way. You have tarnished our whole family line. How could you do this to me? Oh, she just gave it to him. This is disgusting. You, a Christian, speaking like this, that you have these activities with girls. How dare you do this to me? He was just shaking. Tears were coming to his eyes because I was laughing. Now he's getting it. So then she, you know, like a judge, she came down with a verdict. Now you have done this. This is what you must do. I want you to go to every house in the neighborhood. Knock on the door. Introduce yourself. You say, my name is such and such. I am a Christian. I do not have illicit relations with girls. And he had to do that. He went to every house in the neighborhood, knocked on the door. Excuse me, my name is such and such. I am a Christian. I do not have illicit affairs with girls. Many of the houses of people were just... A few of the houses were supportive. Very good, very good. Many houses, oh, you're so-and-so's son. We understand. You've got that strict mother, poor guy, you know. Can't have all the fun that all the teenagers are having. But now, he's such a great devotee of my mother. He thanks her. Thank you for doing that to me when I was young. And now he has children, and when his children tell him the same thing, they're listening to some vulgar rap music. My brother comes home from his clinic, and he finds out they're listening to some vulgar rap music. He just goes right to the stereo, takes the CD, opens the window, tosses it out the window. The children start complaining. All the kids are listening to that. You know, Snoop Doggy Dog, he's our hero. Everyone's listening to him. My brother says, you don't like it? Go talk to your grandmother. So this is the purpose of having family. Not for economic development so much, but more for preserving proper behavior, proper value, proper culture. If the parents take a strong stand, the children will, especially children of devotees, they'll appreciate later. It's just you have to tolerate some temporary turbulence, that's all. All right, we can go on so much about this subject, but it's getting late. So, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Glory to the world.